You are listening to the Charles Bonnet Syndrome Podcast. My name is Shimon Foy, and today's special guest is Dr. Jazlene Jolly. She is an associate professor in vision and eye research at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge, England. She is also the director of Jolly Vision Science. So how are you doing today, Dr. Jolly?
Good, thank you, Shimon. Thank you for having me.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad that you're here. I look forward to discussing the many things that you're involved in for the low vision community, and particularly with Charles-Bonnet syndrome. So can you explain some of the things you do and that you're involved in, what type of doctor you are and researcher that you are?
Yeah, so I originally trained as an optometrist, and so I'm a doctor by PhD, and I did a neuroscience PhD. And basically, I'm doing a number of studies in Charles-Bonnet syndrome at the moment. So I've been seeing patients with Charles-Bonnet syndrome since the very beginning of my career because I've been involved in low vision rehabilitation. So I've been working with Charles-Bonnet syndrome patients for well over 20 years now. So revealing my age there. And so since day one, every time I have a low vision patient, I always ask about whether people experience images that they know aren't really there, or a question along those lines, because I know that people are very reluctant to come forward voluntarily with that information due to the stigma that goes with volunteering that information and how it might be perceived. So I will always ask it proactively, but I know that not enough practitioners necessarily do that. So after I completed my PhD, which was in neuroscience, I realized that actually I can apply those skills to investigating Charles-Bonnet syndrome. So I work with a number of other neuroscientists to further understand that. So my research tries to tackle Charles-Bonnet syndrome from a number of aspects. First of all, there's a myth that Charles-Bonnet syndrome only happens in severe vision loss or in older people. So what I'm trying to do is understand what is the true prevalence of Charles-Bonnet syndrome, because we don't truly know that. Most of the estimates of how common it is has come from case studies, which is not really accurate when you're then extrapolating to how commonly it occurs in the wider population. So I'm trying to do systematic look at that through looking at various hospital populations. And then secondly, we know that Charles-Bonnet syndrome happens in the brain because, there are a number of features. A, the hallucinations are clear when vision is not. B, it happens regardless of what the eye disease is. It doesn't matter where in the visual pathway the image is disrupted. So again, that points to it happening in the brain. So I've been using various brain recording techniques to try and figure out what actually, where the images are then coming from. And other people have also done various bits and pieces of work around this to try and identify that. So I've been trying to do it a bit more systematically and pull all that information together. So those are the two big key strategies that I've been trying to incorporate into my research.
And you mentioned that you were aware of Charles-Bonnet syndrome for many years since you started your practice. How did you first find out about Charles-Bonnet syndrome?
Well, it was mentioned briefly when we were training, and I think I always paid attention to it because it's something interesting, and I think it always struck me as something that must be quite scary. So I think that's possibly why I picked up on it and started being so proactive about asking it. And when you ask about it so proactively, you realize that the incidence of it is actually quite high, much higher than you're led to believe from what we were told in training. And my current studies are actually coming out with much higher prevalence rates than what has been reported previously. We've not quite finished yet, so I can't give you any numbers right now, but ask me in another 3 months or so time, and I will be able to give you proper numbers. But we're also trying to break it down by age, because it's definitely happening in younger age groups than previously thought. So I think the only reason why people thought it was happening in older age groups is because the incidence of eye disease is higher in older age groups. So it's incidental. The age risk factor is not a true separate risk factor. It's just because eye disease is more common in older age groups. And also, we're finding that you can lose vision in one eye only and still get Charles Bonnet syndrome. So the disease severity actually has nothing to do with whether you get Charles Bonnet syndrome or not. And the other thing I'm noticing in the work that we're doing right now is that you don't necessarily get Charles Bonnet syndrome just at the beginning of your vision loss journey. You might get it at any point during that journey. So we as practitioners need to keep asking people, just in case it happens later on, then we shouldn't leave people scared and without advice, whatever time it happens.
It was interesting. You said that people that don't have, let me know if I misunderstood you, but people that don't have severe vision loss can still get Charles Bonnet syndrome. That was my understanding of what I heard.
Correct.
You say. Hopefully that was interesting, because I know that Dr. Dominic Fitch actually was one of the people that helped come up with a guideline saying 60% of your vision loss or more and you get Charles Bonnet syndrome. But now more studies and research are being found to show that you can have less than 60% or better vision and still get it. Has your research shown where that tipping point is, or, you know, is it 50%, 30%, or is that kind of still being researched?
How do you define percentage vision loss? Because there are so many ways to quantify vision loss. So what metric are you actually using? So if you use visual acuity, which is how many letters you can read on the chart, that's one way of defining. You can use visual field, which is peripheral vision. So how much of your peripheral vision do you lose? You can use color vision, you can use, you know, there are so many different ways of defining vision. And then when you combine them all, that's a different measure again. So I always struggle with labeling someone as having lost so much percentage of vision, because what is that actually based on when someone's vision is way more complex than that, when it's made up of all these different attributes? And clinically, we use multiple attributes to measure vision from all these different standpoints. So I think before you can put numbers on how much vision loss someone's got, you need to first define in what way are you measuring that vision loss. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I actually interviewed someone on this podcast and I said, how much vision do you have? And they were like, I don't know. How am I supposed to know? And you just brought up a good point that there's so many factors to the eye because it's so complex, and to the body and to the mind also. So that was really, really interesting. Can you talk about...
Yeah. And sorry, Shimon, just to add to that, like, vision is not just what's the signal that's coming in through the eye, but it's also how the brain interprets that signal as well. So I've got a video on my website about how the eye and the brain interact, which is where my interest in neuroscience started. Because again, I noticed in my low vision clinic that some people adapt to their vision loss better than others. And you can also get these strange symptoms where you've got a brain injury. So your eye is completely normal, but you've got a brain injury, and that can create a different kind of vision loss. The signal that's coming in from the eye is modified by your memories and other bits of processing in the brain. And this is how we see so quickly. So actually, vision is far more complicated than we realize. So there's a lot more to it than just what the signals that hit the back of the eye.
Okay. One thing that's always puzzling to me, or it's just a little confusing to me, is why do some people that have a vision loss get Charles Bonnet and other people do not get Charles Bonnet? Is some of your research looking into that, or do you have any insight into why that may be possible?
We did try and look at that, and that's a very good question. We absolutely did try and look at that, and we did an MRI study, so using magnetic resonance imaging, which is a type of brain scanner, where when I was at Oxford University, we recruited a group of people who had low vision but no hallucinations, and then had similar low vision and did have hallucinations, and we had a look at their brains in the brain scanner to see if we could find any differences. Unfortunately, because the pandemic got in the way, we didn't get the numbers that we were hoping to get. So we didn't find any differences between the two groups. And I don't know whether it's because there are no differences or whether it's because we didn't have the numbers that we needed. So at some point in the future, I would love to rerun that study with larger numbers. So at the moment, I can't answer that question, but nothing obvious jumped out from that study.
Okay. I understand you're currently conducting 5 studies on Charles-Bonnet syndrome. Can you discuss those studies?
Yeah. So 2 are prevalent studies. So I've got a team in Oxford Eye Hospital who are contacting patients who came into the clinics over a certain period and asking them the question, have you ever experienced the symptoms? And if you have, could you complete more in-depth questionnaires? So that's prospective because it's people who came into the clinics last year. And we're just at the moment, most people were asked as they came into clinics, and we're just filling the gaps of the ones who got missed when they came into clinic. Then I've got a team in Cambridge who are looking. So in the UK, when your vision reaches a certain level, you're eligible to be formally registered as sight impaired or severely sight impaired, which is equivalent to partially sighted or blind. And we're phoning people who were registered over 2 6-month periods, 3 years apart. So before the pandemic, after the pandemic, and we're asking them the same question. So the screening question, and if they say yes, then the in-depth questionnaires. So that we're getting an idea of the epidemiology over different age groups, different disease severities. So those are my 2 epidemiology studies. Then the MRI study recently completed, and paper is in review at the moment. Study number 3. Study number 4 is we're recruiting at the moment for an EEG study. So we're measuring the brain waves. So we're looking for people based in the UK who have frequent hallucinations, who can come to Cambridge, and we can measure their brain waves before, during, and after an hallucination. So we can see how the brain waves change before, during, and after the hallucination to give us a clue as to what's actually happening, and whether we can identify whether there are some precursor changes just before the onset of a hallucination. And then the 5th one is I have a student who's comparing. So the other similar syndromes are phantom limb loss and tinnitus, which is what happens when you get hearing loss. So, and phantom limb loss, some people experience phantom limbs after they've had lost a limb. So I've got a student comparing those two to Charles-Bonnet syndrome to see if we can get any clues in the underlying mechanisms or potential treatments. So we're doing a comparison of the three syndromes at the moment, just to get some clues there and see what we can learn from the other two to apply to Charles-Bonnet syndrome at the moment.
Wow, that's a lot of research. And it sounds like important research too. And I like the fact that you're studying different things, comparing different patients and different syndromes or different diseases or what have you. So is there a place, so when these research studies are done, are they listed in like medical literature?
They all will be published in the medical literature. I'm also very active about getting them in the patient population. So last week I presented at the Charles Bonnet UK Information Day, and I'm keen to do strategies like this. I'll be more than happy to come back and share the results with you on this podcast and in other places. So I'll be shouting about the results, but also the reason I've designed these specific studies is I've tried to be very strategic. So if you look at the history of medicine, you need to A, define the problem, which is why I'm doing the studies to define what is the prevalence of Charles Bonnet and which populations it affects. But also, you never get, I've heard so many horror stories from my patients. So patients reported they've been committed because outside of ophthalmology, Charles Bonnet syndrome isn't that widely known amongst other medical groups. So But it's hard to educate doctors when we don't know the underlying cause, not just doctors, but other healthcare professionals as well. So, I mean, if you look at epilepsy wasn't taken seriously until they found out what was happening in the brain. Chronic fatigue syndrome wasn't taken seriously until they found out what was happening in the brain. So many other medical problems were not taken seriously until they found out what was happening physiologically. So that's why I'm doing the neuroscience work, because if we can figure out what exactly is happening, then I can design an education program to go out and educate the medical professionals as to why they should take Charles Bonnet seriously and why, what are the diagnostic factors that they need to be applying whenever they see someone with low vision, whether the low vision is what they're actually treating or whether they are seeing someone for something else, but they're also presenting with low vision, Charles Bonnet hallucinations, because that can easily happen, especially when you're dealing with a patient with multiple things going on. So we need to raise the awareness about Charles Bonnet more widely. But the easiest way to do that is when we know how common it is and when we know what's actually causing it.
That's one of the frustrations that me and a lot of other people have about Charles Bonnet syndrome, is that it's not known. And even ophthalmologists, some of them don't know about it. Or if they do know about it and a patient, they think a patient has it, or the patient says they think they have it, they have nothing to say about it. And we're thinking, some people call it an orphan diagnosis. Some people are just saying when doctors don't have a pill or a treatment for something, they can't really put a lot of focus on it. Some people are saying there's not really medical billing codes, even though there's a few that have been, that have come about now. So what can really change that? Is the only thing that can change that is having someone like yourself and your team maybe identifying it and then coming up with a treatment?
Well, yes, raising awareness is definitely key, and that's why we're doing all this research. And then also, I think, frustratingly, self-advocation by patients. So the more awareness we can raise among the low vision population as well, don't be afraid to speak out and don't be afraid to take a leaflet along to your doctor and go, do you think it could be this? So that they get educated that way as well, which shouldn't be the case, but quite often when medics see something in practice, they're more likely to remember it as well. But we are trying really hard to educate the medical population. So I've been writing articles both in the medical press but also in the lay press a lot. And my team are presenting at, I think, 5 conferences between us over the last 9 months. Collectively, the next one is in April. So, you know, we are trying really hard between us to get the message out. We're writing numerous papers between us as well for the medical journals to get the message out. So, but the more we can do, so podcasts like this, getting the message out to the patient population as well can only help.
Thank you for all the things you're doing. I really appreciate that. Can you talk a little bit about Jolly Vision Science?
Yeah, so this is a company that I've set up recently because a lot of clinical trials are not done as robustly as they should be, and they fail at the final hurdle of translating because they're not using the right outcome measures. So you can have the best therapy in the world, but if you can't prove it works, it's never going to get accepted as a treatment. So Jolly Vision Science was set up partly because I work with outcome measures. I specialize in knowing how to prove a therapy. So it was partly set up for that aim, to advise companies on choosing the right outcome measures and stop clinical trials falling down at that last hurdle at the clinical trials stage, and partly to bring in EDIA, so equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility. So I think a lot more work in the medical arena would be more successful if we had a more diverse voice in there. So if we had more disabled scientists, for example, if we had more people with disabilities working in the healthcare sector, because then we're going to have more nuance in the discussion. We're going to have more insights into what the issues actually are and what the difficulties are. So I do a lot of work on a national level about this side of things as well, as I think it's just so critical. So I think we need to stop thinking of scientists as, you know, the traditional model of a straight white man in a white lab coat. For context, I am a brown, petite female. So it's been very hard for me to get to where I am.
Well, equity and inclusion is such an important, and diversity is so important. So I'm glad that you are definitely trying to address that. It brings different perspectives. It just helps to really have role models and people you can look up to. So I appreciate you doing what you do, because like you said, it may have not been easy. You have a lot of different barriers.
No, and I've just hired a blind research scientist for one of my projects, because actually patients are not just patients. Every single person, regardless of background, disability, is a valuable member of society with skills. Just because you have a disability doesn't mean you lose your knowledge, your skills, and what you bring to the table. We should be creating an environment where if we can build in accessibility, we can harness all that skills and knowledge. We shouldn't be making people fight for it, because otherwise we're going to lose that. And especially since long COVID, this is going to be a bigger problem than ever, because so much of the workforce is automatically being taken out now because of that issue.
Wow. So if there was a doctor that was listening to this podcast and they weren't that familiar with Charles-Bonnet syndrome, what advice would you give to them to maybe help them get more familiar or be able to offer some assistance to their patients?
Ask every single patient that you see whether they experience things that they know are not really there, whether they feel their eyes play tricks on them. Do not use the word hallucination, because that has negative connotations and immediately scares people. So frame it in the way that I've just said. They report they do. Reassure them that they are not going crazy. As long as they report insight into the fact that they can logic that those things are not real. So they might look real, but they can logic the fact that they are not real. Then you can reassure them that it is Charles-Bonnet syndrome, and because once people can attach a label to it and then know what they are, reassurance is a huge part of fighting it. Giving that syndrome a label is a huge, huge part of learning to deal with it. There are several other strategies that if people find them distressing, that can be offered, though not everybody finds them distressing. So if people enjoy them, great, reassure them and let them enjoy them. If they are bothersome, because sometimes when they, even if the images aren't distressing per se, they can be bothersome because they occlude view of other things or they come out of nowhere and can be really surprising and therefore interfere. But people can close their eyes and just relax. People can be told to look away, or some people find it beneficial to interact with them and that makes them go away. Some people can just ignore them. Some people might find it helpful to try and move them into a different part of their visual field. So different people will have different strategies that work for them. No one size fits all. Stress will make them worse. Loneliness will make them worse. So encourage people to talk about them to their loved ones, because trying to hide them will induce stress and likely actually make them worse. And taking ownership of them will reduce their power to intimidate.
Thank you for that advice. We actually have an episode that's going to come up where we discuss the coping mechanisms and give tips based off things that people with Charles-Bonnet syndrome have told us or that we've heard, things that were on the ESMES Umbrellas website and things that Dr. Gary Cusick said.
Fantastic.
Are there any medicines that have been proven to help or that are being developed that may be able to help?
There have been a few that have been tried, but none that have consistently come out as being super effective. And medicines all have side effects. So I am wary to recommend anything. And this is another reason for looking at the neuroscience, because once we figure out exactly what's going on, then we can recommend where drugs should be developed to target the actual cause. But at the moment, I haven't seen anything convincing really to hone in on what's actually going on.
Okay. This question just came to my head, and I'm not really a medical person, so hopefully I framed the question correctly. But with diseases and syndromes and things like that, is it usually more than one cause? So maybe like one person gets this type of cancer because they smoked and another person it's genetic or something. And if that is the case, is it possible that Charles-Bonnet syndrome could have different causes aside from just a vision loss? Do you have any insight into that, or has there ever been any studies or publications you read about that?
That's a very intriguing question, Shimon. I don't know. It's the honest answer. I honestly don't know. I mean, it only ever happens following vision loss. So that is absolutely essential, because it's the loss of the sensory input from the eyes that triggers Charles-Bonnet. Whether there are other factors in addition to that, there could well be, which might explain why some people get it and some don't. I think there's definitely scope for future research there. But yeah, that's a very intriguing thought. I don't know. But if there are other causes, I don't think they would be relevant without having the vision loss, because you need the sensory deafferentation for it to be triggered.
Is there a way that people can sign up for studies or a website where they can register if they want to be a part of it, instead of you and your team reaching out to them?
Yeah, so the Vision and Eye Research Institute, which is where I work at the moment, we do have a page where people can sign up to be a volunteer and get notified of potential studies that are coming up in the future. It's also, for those in the UK, so my studies are only open to people in the UK because our travel budgets don't extend for overseas travel. And also much of our funding comes from NHS sources. So that's one of our rules. Anyone in the UK can register as a member of ESMA's umbrella, which is the UK charity for Charles-Bonnet syndrome. And then we advertise all of our Charles-Bonnet studies with ESMA's umbrella. And then you can get in touch. We'll give you the email address where to contact for any studies that we're recruiting for. So that's a really good mechanism because then you'll be notified of studies from around the country. Clinicaltrials.gov is a place where a lot of clinical trials get registered, but studies which are non-interventional. So the difference between clinical trials and clinical studies is trials are testing out a new treatment. We'll go on clinicaltrials.gov, but studies, so most of the work I do are clinical studies, so we're looking for the underlying mechanisms. They won't necessarily be registered on clinicaltrials.gov. So you can look up for trials on clinicaltrials.gov, but studies, it's just a matter of looking at Facebook groups, looking at newsletters of various organizations, and just seeing what is being advertised. But we're always looking for recruits, and I tend to advertise my studies in a variety of sources because we're always looking for volunteers to come take part in the studies, as we really can't get any of this knowledge without your help.
So what is the NHS for people that are not from the UK?
Sorry, yes, I should have specified. The NHS is our National Health Service. So it's basically our public health body that covers it's health service for everybody.
When I was reading up about you and looking through your bio, I saw a word that was interesting and I wanted to ask you, what does it mean? It says electrophysiology. What is that?
Yeah, that's my clinical specialty. So I put electrodes in people's eyes and I measure the signal that's being produced by the cells at the back of the eye and by the nerve in the eye, to measure how well those cells are working and how well the nerves are working. So this allows me to see which cells the problem is in, or whether the nerve pathway, so the nerve carries the signals from the eye to the brain, and is that working properly? So it can help in the diagnosis and monitoring of a lot of different types of diseases. So yeah, that's my clinical specialty.
That sounds interesting.
I love it.
Now, I noticed that you're doing a lot of work in the UK, and it seems like the UK is the leader in research for Charles-Bonnet syndrome, but there are other doctors in different parts of the world that are interested in it and doing their own research. What would it take for people to not be working in silos and to have larger trials and studies and more collaboration? What would that process be like? And is that normal for a condition?
Yeah, I work with partners all around the world. So I have collaborators in Australia, in the US, in Ghana, in all over the world, basically. So if people are interested in working together, please do get in touch with myself or with other people who are working in the field and discuss working together with us, because there's always more work needed, and the more places that get involved, the better we can get to the findings more quickly. So collaborations are the norm in the kind of medical work that we're doing, and then we need to basically look at raising funding for the different projects and how we would go about doing it.
What would you say to someone that is younger, or I don't want to discriminate, somebody may be older and want to become a doctor. What would you say to someone that is contemplating becoming a medical professional and they are maybe thinking, do they want to be a researcher or do they want to be a general practitioner or family care doctor? What would you say to have them consider being a researcher? Because I think it's important to get more researchers and to have people consider that path. What would you say, since you're a researcher yourself?
I count myself as a clinician scientist, so I do both clinical work and research. And since the beginning of my career, I've always done a little bit of research as part of my job. So I didn't do so much research at the beginning. At the beginning of my career, I would just get involved in other people's studies, do some work for them. And then as my research has become more successful, I've bought out more of my time from the clinical work to increase my research portfolio. And plus, I realized that I enjoyed that more. And you don't need to rush the research pathway. So I did my master's degree 7 years after qualifying, and then I did my PhD 7 years after that. So you don't need to rush into things. You can build things up on the side, and you don't need to be just a doctor. Like all healthcare professionals should get involved in research, whatever level you're at, because it's very satisfying. And also, research shows that the places that are research active tend to have higher patient satisfaction. You get higher patient care in those places as well. So there is a lot of advantages of doing research, but it can be as little or as much as you want. So it doesn't have to be 50-50. You can split it in any way that you want. And it doesn't mean that you have to lead the studies. It means you can get involved in other people's work just to get some skills.
What would you say to someone that's listening that has Charles-Bonnet syndrome and they're having a really difficult time? It's one of the more severe cases. What would you say to maybe encourage them?
Don't let it own you. You own it. You are not going crazy. I promise you, you are not going crazy. It is more common than you think. So please talk to other people about it, because the more you talk about it, the less it will own you. And I wish I could give you a hug.
Yeah. Because they're not alone. Whenever I go to the support groups, I say they're very strong and they're just encouraging me to be dealing with something and continue going on and dealing with it, doing the best they can, coming to the groups for support. A lot of people don't want to discuss it, but I think that's important to really try to find someone that you can trust, whether it's a family member, a doctor, a therapist, and just discuss it, because you have to get things off your chest and get over the stigma. And then more people can find out about Charles-Bonnet syndrome when they hear people becoming advocates about it. There's one person I interviewed on this podcast, and he said everywhere they go, they talk about it. And that can be an extreme for some, and everybody's personality is different, but that can definitely help spread the word.
Yeah, and if you don't want to talk about it to strangers, then the support groups are brilliant, because they're a safe space where you know people are going to completely understand what you're saying and where you're coming from.
Yeah, so I'm so grateful for the support groups, and they have them all over in the UK and America, Australia, even Canada. So really, really grateful for that. So what's the best way for people to find more information about you, whether it's a website, Twitter, or what's the best way for people to get info?
You can follow me on Twitter at JKJolly4. My website is jollyvisionscience.com, and there's quite a few videos on there, including talks I've given about Charles-Bonnet syndrome and the little video about how the eye and the brain interacts. So please feel free to check that out. And I've got a university profile on both Anglia Ruskin and Oxford University websites as well.
Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. It's been a really nice conversation.